Yeah. Well, we landed in Gander to a pleasant reception. Gander had been an operational base on the east coast of mm-hmm. Canada, Eastern Air Command, we looked upon it purely as a staging point. I see here we landed on the 19th of June. I think we landed at something like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. Had a fast drink into bed, some breakfast, I expect, although we'd eaten on board en route, box lunches. And I see on the same date, 19th, we flew directly over to Skidook. Skidook was, as I recall, an RCF repair depot for Eastern Air Command. And the great event there was, Skidook was very close to, what's the strait between Prince Edward Island and the mainland? Northumberland? Is it the Northumberland Strait? Well, anyway, great mm-hmm. lobster and oyster area. And we hadn't seen a lobster and oyster since we left. So the big event, I'm pretty sure we probably hit the pits pretty early on the night of the 19th, but on the 20th, I seem to remember an enormous lobster lunch, and one or two of us quite ill. This food was so rich, all the whiskey, all the beer, all of that good stuff. The Canadian diet suddenly struck us as being so much richer than anything we had.
What about the townsfolk? They got a band out and things like that.
No, these were what we had. 40-odd aircraft coming in, maybe even more, and it was a very functional, professional event. There was no great greeting party, other than a very
wonderful lobster. And
yeah, but also the staff of Skidook were enormously helpful, and we felt welcomed. But there was no downtown reception or anything of this sort. We were just a couple of squadrons going through. The big game now was to get out of Skidook just as rapidly as you could back home, yeah. to wherever home was, and Skidook was of course on the Halifax Montreal line, or within mm-hmm. just a few minutes of it. So the problem now was to get all of these crews, air crew and ground crew. We were leaving the aircraft there in Skidook. Our job was over now, and we were now on home leave for the first time. I had been away almost, well, what, about 2 years and five months, and my wife was in Montreal, St. Lambert, and we were all allowed, I think, one or two free long distance calls out of Skidook, and I suppose in 40 aircraft we probably had upwards to 400 people, and 400 people all wanting to use one or two telephones through that little
right
Skidook,
now
right now through that little Skidook switchboard, kind of saturated the system. But all of us finally got through. We got through quickly, simply to say we're here and we're coming home. None mm-hmm. of us knew on that first telephone call when we were going to be able to get on board a train.
So would rank have its privilege?
Say?
Would rank have its privilege now?
Not really. No, we didn't do it that way. But what we needed was a whole train's worth, pretty well, and that was arranged. And I think we were out of Skidook within 48 hours. Mm-hmm. Not bad, you know. They laid on a special train for us. Now we were all Tiger Force, so the idea was to get us home fast.
So you come back fast.
So you could get back soonest. And I can't remember whether it was a month's leave or 2 weeks' leave. It wasn't terribly long. It would be, yes, it would be about a month. That would be it. Yeah, I see in my logbook that I'm back in Halifax on the 23rd of July, and here it was 1920, 21 June. It'd be a month's worth.
So you got on a train and away you went, eh?
Got on a train, and I guess the train took what, 24 hours out of there? I can't remember.
Now you would have part of your pay held back in Canada, is that correct? Or was that just the government's way of not paying you?
I, as a married man, I made allotments.
No, I'm thinking outside of your allotment. Wasn't part of your pay automatically held?
I don't remember any deferred pay.
Oh, okay.
Why do you raise it? Have you heard there was?
Yeah, I've heard of people that had deferred pay. I guess when they were stationed with RAF people as well. The one instance I'm thinking of.
Ah, you mean this was sort of a...
He was RCAF with seconded to RAF overseas.
Was this some kind of equalizing arrangement?
Probably, I would think. Yeah. Maybe I've got it balled up.
I don't remember any deferral of my pay at all. I had allotted... I've even forgotten how much.
Well, it's not important. I just wanted to... You weren't coming home to a nice check, in other words, is what I'm getting at.
No, but I expected the pay that I had that allotted would be safely banked back home, and in fact it was. But no, I had no. Now they gave us a month's pay in advance to cover the leave period. But I remember things going very, very smoothly and uneventfully. In Skidoo, good fast treatment, well organized. We were in and out in what seemed to be at the time any delay whatsoever was seemed like eternity, but we were in and out of Skidoo very, very swiftly indeed. And then to Montreal, met by my wife. You were talking about reception coming back. In my experience, very few airmen other than arrangements by local family had any special reception, because airmen tended to come home in small numbers, ones and twos, whereas I suppose an infantry regiment returning to, say, the Van Dues returning to Quebec City, it would be a city event, and there would be a large group arriving at one.
Well,
one
your
time.
Squadron wasn't adopted by a city en route, then, eh?
420 had been adopted by. City of London, but as a squadron, 420 never went near London.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no opportunity there for a special
to cash in,
a special reception. So as of I suppose around the 22nd, 23rd of June, I was home from the European theater. Still hadn't told my wife or any of my family that I had volunteered for Tiger Force. And in fact, never did tell until after VJ Day. And VJ Day, believe me, was a day of great relief for me, because I
didn't want to bust the news, eh?
I knew now that I didn't have to, we didn't have to proceed to the Japanese theater. Although the promise of a new area down into the South Seas all had its attraction, but as it subsequently developed, we didn't move. So why don't we leave it that on or about the 23rd of June 1945, home from the wars in Europe, and we'll pick it up from there.
Sounds great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Right.
My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N. I'm with Major General G.J.J. Edwards, DFC, CD. General Edwards was with the Royal Canadian Air Force and later the Canadian Forces. The date today is 17 August 1979, and we're at General Edwards' home in Central Saanich.
North
Saanich. Dean Park Estates is what it is. Well, I saw the Central Saanich Fire Department on the way in.
So you
I
did,
figured,
eh? You had it burned in your brain, obviously.
I got Central Sandage burned in my brain. As I say, the date today is 17 August, and last day we got as far as you coming home, getting your month's leave, and then volunteering for the Tiger Force?
Tiger Force, yeah. Well, having volunteered several months before, but now being called into the nucleus planning headquarters for the Canadian Air Force participation in Tiger Force, RCF participation in Tiger Force. And the
this was one of these purely volunteer jobs again, is that right?
Yeah.
You had to volunteer for the Japanese War.
That's right. All part of the Canadian pattern, yeah.
Yeah. How did you feel about this thing in the sense that I know I've talked to a couple of admirals who felt this was the most despicable thing ever, in that giving sailors a choice and airmen
double,
a choice.
Double volunteering into the service and volunteering for duty.
You know, you're in a war or you're not,
yeah.
And this whole nonsense, did you figure that was... have any feelings on it, is what I'm asking?
Well, feelings were... one of, I suppose in part, confusion, with a touch of anger. It wasn't until later when we were able to better analyze what this volunteering philosophy really meant in a sense of a national attitude and national image that the real impact came home. But at the time, you felt one felt pretty damn superior if you had volunteered Tiger Force and your friend in the next room or at the dinner table had not, you felt that some of them were opting out too soon, that the war wasn't over yet, and it was a fairly fleeting thing. But more importantly, now in July of 1945, down in Nova Scotia, principally, all of the RCAF that would be used for Tiger Force were assembled there, so all of your immediate colleagues were on the same boat, as it were. And while across the harbor, we were in Halifax, across the harbor in Dartmouth, there had been formed an enormous release depot, and the chaps coming back from principally from Europe were being staged through this release depot. So while you were sitting in Halifax, we were sitting in Halifax planning for the rest of the war, and tens of thousands were pouring through the release depot, leaving the war, as it were. And that was a bit of a contradiction. It was. But as I say, you felt vastly superior.
Real cut above, eh?
It was damned exciting getting on with it.
What about in Halifax itself at this time? I guess the town would be reeling from the VE Day riots, and then they had a small explosion after the riots.
Yeah.
Do you recall anything about those?
No, except very heavy shore patrols on the part of the RCN that. That didn't really affect us.
Mm-hmm.
We had very few airmen in the Halifax area, in the immediate Halifax
mm-hmm.
area. The airmen were over at RCF Station Dartmouth, across the harbor. We were mostly an officer's staff
mm-hmm.
in Halifax. So we had very, very little to do with RCN, except Eastern Air Command, of course, had worked closely with the Canadian Atlantic Fleet in anti-submarine warfare,
yes,
and that relationship was certainly continuing.
I'm just thinking of the reaction of the people of Halifax towards you. Were you a good guy because you were in light blue as opposed to dark blue?
Yeah, I don't think it was sharply. I don't think it was sharply evident, but certainly the Haligonian civilians, the non-military, were not loath to talk about the outbreak and the outrage talked to sailors, and it was hard to know on what side to come down. We tended to go with the sailors. We thought the Haligonians had ripped them off, and we were certainly encouraged by our Canadian naval friends and colleagues that in part was responsible for the unfortunate event. But we remember, I remember going through Halifax. I really sailed to Europe out of Halifax. We sailed out of New York finally, but even at that point in time, we thought the Haligonians were taking advantage of the military in general, sailors, soldiers, and airmen. And there was residual resentment. So we didn't find it too difficult to believe what our RCN friends told us about the events leading up to it,
you see that,
and the underlying causes.
You're meaning that like being charged a little more for goods and services, not disrespect, but shoddier treatment, say, than they would give a civilian?
That was the impression we had. Right or wrong, that's mm-hmm. what that's many of us believed at the time, that we were a blight to be endured. And I suppose on sober reflection years later, then the local citizens had a point too. They were saturated. It's easy to have a balanced view now at the time, but we weren't violently anti. We had friends in Halifax. We were sailing with them out of the Halifax Yacht Club. We played golf with them,
mm-hmm.
and ate out, that sort of thing. It was a sobering experience for the Haligonians, and by the time we arrived in July, I suspect their attitude—they had shifted ground, and there were still long lineups going into dining rooms and that sort of thing. And whereas at one time we believed we could really never ever make a reservation and expect the thing to be held anywhere, now in July and August of 45, it seemed the treatment was better. Mind you, the sheer joy of being back with lights on and better food and back with your families made us all quite a bit more mellow.
Easier than, to take.
We might otherwise have been.
Some more wild times in the town. Eh? Well, sir, you're planning for this force. Now, what is the idea? What is your particular task here? Are you getting crews together, type of thing, or just
no? The squadrons were already formed, and they were in places like Yarmouth. Where were they? Let me see. Now that I raise it, I can't remember. I know there were two squadrons in Yarmouth. I think we had one or two squadrons over in Dartmouth. We had, I think, a couple in Greenwood as well. There were more, and I can't remember where they are. And I've forgotten the exact size of the RCF contribution to Tiger Force. We had brought the Lancasters back, but we understood that we were going to be flying another type of British aircraft, and the name of that escapes me, too. The Lincoln. The Lincoln was to be the Lincoln. The Lincoln was a blown up Lancaster, longer range, bigger engines, bigger aircraft all around.
Bigger.
Needed because we expected to be operating from islands in the Pacific, and we needed mm-hmm. the longer range, which the Lancaster didn't have. So what was happening? We were assembling crews, working out ferry plans. How are we going to get to the Japanese theater? All pretty vague. We didn't have very much to go on. So what we were tending to do was simply continue training as we had in UK, but with more emphasis now on long range over water. We continued to do, there were bombing ranges down there. We continued to drop practice bombs as we had in UK. And we were sitting really waiting for some of the specifics on which we could develop a positive plan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, events events overtook, and
but your particular task now as a wing commander.
I'm a wing commander, and I am Air One. I am the deputy chief of operations, if you'd like.
And your boss would be what, a group captain?
A group captain, yeah. And we had an air vice marshal in charge, and we were going to be the headquarters that moved to the Pacific to run the RCF portion of participation with the RAF, and all of that in concert with the Americans. But as I say, it lasted. I got back to Halifax from 1 month's leave on the 23rd of July, and in something like 3 weeks, VJ Day, and the whole thing was over.
What was the feeling for you as a pilot and a bomber concerning these new bombs, the atomic bombs, and the information that was coming at the time and being used by an air force, if you will, you know, from a bomber as opposed to a land-based operation?
Yeah, what you mean, moral outrage or something?
No. Nothing as crass as that. I'm thinking. Even dropping high explosives and incendiaries, and here's something new, a new weapon system, if you will, a new, and of course being built up as the ultimate at that time. I'm just thinking, what were your feelings there? I'm not talking about the moral outrage and all that. That comes in peacetime. That doesn't come more.
Yeah. Well, the great urge was to beat the bastards, and we didn't know much about the A-bomb. Other than it was one hell of a big bang, we really didn't have much information, if any, of reliability and accuracy about the damage to Nagasaki and what was the other one?
Hiroshima.
Except that it must have been one enormous blast. And I think we were as vague as that. The intelligence we had on it was very, very limited. Mm-hmm. Down in Halifax, in this nucleus headquarters, I would have expected that the Americans would have transmitted Washington, Ottawa on that. And there was some greater, well, obviously greater knowledge and better appreciation.
I'm just thinking of the new. Did you see this as things to come, and boy, when we get ours, type of thing?
Yeah, I don't remember that. I don't remember that feeling. We certainly discussed it, and of course the
what I'm getting at is a new development in the Air Force, if you will.
Yeah.
Aerial tactical.
Yeah. The term atomic bomb was being bandied about, but I don't think we had any real grasp of the long range significance of it, except it was a most potent weapon. And good for us that we had it, and and we were foreshortening the war. We certainly sensed that there was that. Mm-hmm. We, as we discussed a little earlier, there was a lull to wait for the real impact of that drop to have its effect, and it didn't take long. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that at the time we were reading to or hearing about other Japanese attempts to sue for peace, not unlike the German pattern, and as I recall the feeling, this should hasten that, and really not much more. We were so preoccupied with our own day-to-day military affairs, gearing up for this new thing, that it really wasn't until VJ Day that we realized what an enormous event it had been. And indeed, it wasn't until a few months later, when I was in the RCF Staff College in Toronto, that we really had a chance to sit down and discuss what it all meant. But that comes a little okay. Later.
Well, VJ Day itself, I know the Navy took measures to ensure there would be no repeat of VE Day.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of where were you? What were you doing?
Let's see. My wife had come down from Montreal, and we were living in Halifax, no way of getting an apartment or a house in those days, so we had chopped around for a very comfortable room that we found with a widow and her two daughters in a very, very attractive district. And we were surrounded by my old six group confreres, a few with their wives, but VJ Day was a... VJ Day to us wasn't nearly as emotional as VE Day.
Hmm. Well, that was your war.
That was our war.
Yes, sir.
But...
speaking of your war, did you hear about the Bomber Harris Medal and all those sort of things? Did you hear about the conflict of that? That Harris wanted a medal issued for Bomber Command. He got the campaign ribbon.
Yeah.
Air Crew Europe.
Yeah, Air Crew Europe,
but,
right.
But there was, Harris wanted that Bomber Medal.
Yeah.
And the story goes, due to many things, and especially Dresden and all the outrage, if you will, and a few things like that, it never came about. Did you hear any of that battle, or was it just too high up?
I remember it vaguely. I can't remember at what stage, but quite honestly, we weren't medal hunting.
No, I know that. I'm not trying to imply that, sir.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering of. Now that we're at the end of the war, what I'm getting at is the big debates now of Bomber Command
effectiveness.
Well, Bomber Command was looked on for some reason as the merchants of death, if you will. They really. What do they do but, you know, kill a lot of people and kill a lot of themselves.
Yeah.
Bomber Command had the nice clean sheets. They weren't in the real fighting, quote, real fighting. Bomber Command, what were some of the other... Oh, I'm sorry, not just Bomber Command, but the Canadian Air Force was at the pointy end of the stick, but didn't seem to be at the pointy end of the stick when decisions were made. It was all RAF and all these other arguments and philosophies, and now we have peace, if you will, and I would think that now it's time to sit back and not just reminisce, but to discuss.
Yeah, that for me came later after staff college, moved from staff college back into Air Force, my first
mm-hmm.
time in Air Force headquarters. It was not an issue. It was not an issue in mid-1945. We didn't give it a hell of a lot of thought, except I do remember, and this occurred even earlier, I do remember the growing burn amongst... The more senior officers, say wing commander on up,
mm-hmm.
about the lack of RCF representation in Bomber Command. We were talking about it as early as 1944, realizing that Bomber Command was almost entirely an RAF preserve, sixth group,
mm-hmm.
almost entirely Canadian. But we sensed it even then that the distribution of power did not seem to quite
right.
balance with the distribution of operational crews, and we were aware of it.
You think this is the start of the disenchantment with the RAF and the growth?
Well, not with the RAF crews. And,
but I'm talking about the whole institution of the RAF versus the American, and the switch towards the American.
But you know that really didn't come about until. Perhaps as late as 1950.
Yes.
So 5 years went by before.
But
it was gelling. It was gelling. And it was certainly starting.
Well, the seeds came during the war, though. That was
No question. And as young and as uninformed and unsophisticated as we were, we sensed something strange even then. I don't think we were able to articulate it too well, but...
We learned to articulate later
and to take very positive action to correct it.
Hmm. And again, not metal happy, but that whole bit about what I'm getting at, sir, if I can say this, is that I've heard others say Well, Fight to Command, were the, as you know, were the glamour boys.
Yeah.
And they were the pretty boys and all the rest of this thing. But the Bomber Command didn't get the recognition, if you will, or the appreciation of the people, or whatever you want to call it. They didn't even get the lousy medal out of it.
Yeah. But no command, there? But no command, no operational command ever got a medal as such. In that sense.
No, I understand that. But what I'm getting at was that there was was almost as if you were in bombers, you were the bad guy.
Well, not the bad guy. The way I sensed it,
okay.
Bomber Command was not your first choice. Bomber Command, well, it was, quite honestly, pretty damn dull flying. You were lumbering through the night in a very heavy airplane with sort of the minimum performance, and
mm-hmm.
You dumped your load and you came home. You know, basically, it was kind of dull stuff. I would say that Coastal Command was rather dull stuff,
mm-hmm.
although there were a great number of dedicated Coastal Command guys. I thought it was the only way to fight a war.
What I'm getting at, I guess, is this, is that everyone has their grievance. You don't have it bad, I got it bad. But what I'm trying to do is with the bomber gear, old six group, buddies, and being in sixth group, one, you didn't have a say where you were going because that was the RAF dictating. You weren't getting special recognition as some people felt you should. You were doing the slugging as opposed to the jabbing and flittering about. You weren't getting the appreciation. Get out my violin in a minute. But you weren't getting the appreciation of the public and things. What I'm getting at, was there any resentment around the mess and things about how we're not getting our due?
No, I think you're building a scenario that I certainly didn't detect.
Great.
At the time.
Okay.
I did not. While Bomber Command may not have been the first choice of many, once you're in it and had formed your crews and had your relationship with other crews and growing pride in your squadron's accomplishment, These other issues were not constant conversation in any mess or amongst crews. You were more concerned with the particular day, the particular operational raid you were going on, getting over and getting back. Well, getting off in the first instance.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall that. Now, have you talked to airmen who seriously felt that way? That think they recall that that's the way it was? Because I'd be surprised to hear that.
I have talked to people that were in fighters that looked on bombers, if you will, as the bad guys.
The bad guys, or those poor bastards have to be on bombers?
The bad guys.
The bad guys.
Well, he was a Navy pilot anyway.
Yeah. Well,
what I'm getting at is that I'm glad you're setting the record straight here. Is what I'm creating, perhaps even creating more of an issue, obviously, than there was. But I think that scenario can be made, and that point can be made that Bomber didn't get its true recognition, and weren't given their due, for considering the contribution that they made.
Mm-hmm.
The Glory Boys were fighters. The Glory Boys were, in battleships. Navy of the Army was slugging along, but without bombers, of course, the slugging probably would have been a little tougher. I just wonder if there was much crying in the beer around the mess.
No.
And during that time.
No, no. And I wish we had a group of six group around just to refresh my own.
Eh?
No, not that. Remember, I'm going back over 30 years, but I don't remember coming out of it feeling that A, we were the bad guys, or B, that we weren't really being appreciated. One just didn't think in those terms at that time.
What about later, sir? What about 45, 46, 47, and then the business about Dresden coming out and that?
I knew all about Dresden. I was on the ops staff when Dresden took place, and I remember the night very, very well indeed. We
thought it was one hell of a raid. It was one. It was an enormously successful raid because the reports coming back, of course, about the firestorm and the Dresden raging. But we didn't even sense. Or let me. I won't generalize. I didn't sense any moral outrage on that. It was a means, albeit on later reflection, of very cruel means of bringing the war in Europe to a successful conclusion as far as we were concerned. We knew, I remember in the briefing before the Dresden raid, we knew what was on the ground. It was clogged with German refugees. It seems to me that it was a rail point as well, of sorts. It must have been something like that. I'm grabbing a bit here.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to be a pretty sensible target. When at our point in planning, and it was a bomber command directive that we'd be doing it, and we were discussing how best to attack and that sort of thing, the right bomb loads. I don't think there was any conscious knowledge that a firestorm would burn tens of thousands of people.
No, I'm not getting at the moral outrage. What I'm getting at is, like what you said, I believe you were there to win a war. Better that guy than me, but.
But not any means to justify the end. It seemed to be a logical target.
What I'm getting at, sir, is what about when it was thrown in your face?
Later?
Yes. What I'm getting about is, look at those terrible guys. Look what they did for no strategic reason. At least that's the argument they made.
Yeah. Well.
Now I'm not about to argue whether or not there was a reason, but I'm saying the argument there and thrown in your face. And the implication being that you should be ashamed.
I would have to admit that as late as now, I have no... I'm sorry it was done that way. There may have been a better way to do it. I wasn't privy to the options available at the time. But the selection of Dresden in an
attempt... Well, we're using that as the example.
Well, Dresden is a very good example. Mm-hmm. I think it was perhaps one of the... To my knowledge, one of the few raids where it turned out to be a terror raid, but in the planning process, it seemed to be, the way it was presented down at group level, to be a logical target to hasten the end of.
What about when it was thrown in your face?
Later on.
Yes.
I still feel no enormous remorse. In the terms that I have described, from a moral point of view, it was a horror, no question about it. But at that point in time, I wish if we had been in a selection seat, one likes to think that one might have done it differently. But recalling, and I think that's the important thing, to recall the attitude at the time, it did not offend me or any of my colleagues on the air staff in 6th Group Headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a sad commentary, but
no, I don't. I
think
those I don't
are the
so.
Those
no.
are the facts. Now, as far as being
well, what
being a bad
here,
guy, I have no sense of being a bad
okay,
guy.
I think we've got that. Back just for a moment on Dresden before we switch over the tape here. Of course, the thing was that they built it as part of the rationale. They built it up that this was the revenge for what they had done to Coventry and to London and the Blitz. And
well, that may
Churchill
have been that may have been a bomber that may have been a bomber command position, but it didn't transmit down that way to the Canadian group.
Well, that's what I was getting at. You weren't aware, or at least you weren't told that this. If that indeed was the case, that it was our retribution fate.
We had no sense of vindictiveness on the part of Bomber Command. It was another
target.
It was another target. I don't know. We had done Dusseldorf. We had done Bremen. We had and up comes Dresden. First time on Dresden, of course. for us. And the penny didn't drop. Now, what you're implying may or may not be so. At that point in time,
mm-hmm.
it was not, there was no sense of hesitation on our part.
It was another target.
Another target.
Yours was not the reason why?
Well, I like to think airmen are a little smarter than that, but it was all part of a pattern. Now, if someone had said at that point in time, this is a raid to kill 250,000 people, I don't know what we'd have done under those circumstances. One would have expected your AOC to protest, I suppose, but it didn't come down in those terms. And I don't know, it may have been a surprise even to the bomber command target selectors, the enormity of the results, the general horror of it.
We've got, I guess, about a minute and a half on this side. Sticking with generalities again with the war on targets, the attitude then was not a question of why we should be bombing Hamburg, not Berlin, or we as pilots should not be going here, but should be rather going there where it would do more good. You never had that attitude, is that correct? What I'm getting at is that it was all part of a master scheme, and your part of the scheme was to do as you were told. Is that correct?
Yeah. I think that, in the simplest of terms, was probably the position. But you see, say an attack on a rail center on the outskirts of Brussels, we were in no position to say, we shouldn't be bombing that rail center by Brussels, we should be bombing the rail center by Stettin, or we should be bombing the rail center so-and-so. You didn't have enough information at our level to really sensibly, professionally challenge the target selection pattern. We were all aware of a master plan, intelligence feeding into Bomber Command,
mm-hmm.
suggesting, for instance, before VE Day that we should go for major dislocation of the rail system into the Normandy area, which in fact we did, along with Fighter Command, the interdiction of the battlefield
before D-Day. Yeah.
Before D-Day. Sorry, D-Day. Yeah. We knew that on our maps we could see the advancing Russian line suddenly appearing on the most easterly portions of our
horizon,
maps, moving
yeah.
forward, moving forward, using Dresden as an example. We knew it was clogged. We had a sense of assisting our Russian allies, and we could look at target selection and in our own minds individually rationalize that was all part of the pattern, say to assist the Russians or to assist our own troops on the Western Front.
Mm-hmm.
But to discriminate between individual targets really wasn't within our capability, certainly not my capability, and I wasn't aware of anyone at group that was deploring
mm-hmm.
the target selection.
Also, I gather the only hesitation or complaint by you at that time would be if it would be a tough run, like if you were going, say, to Berlin or Hamburg or whatever, a long run, and go, oh God, here we go again. As opposed to, well, we really shouldn't be doing Berlin.
That's,
is that correct?
That's broadly correct.
Okay. I shall flip the tape over and we shall continue on the other side.